Only 3 weeks ago, the director of the All India Radio station in Pondicherry, he approached the mother for a special message for the 15th and also requested her to say something about Sri Aurobindo for about 10 minutes. Nowadays, mother is not very much inclined to give messages and of course to write something to last for 10 minutes was out of question. All the same, when I conveyed the request, she asked for a pen and wrote out one sentence. It came to her first in French. She rendered it in English. And then I proposed to her that from her various writings and comments and messages, I would prepare a script on the subject. She said, very well. About 10 or 12 days later, I took the script and read it out to her. That was broadcast last night at 9:15. And I'm not sure how many of our friends have heard it, and I thought it better that we all could hear it once again if we have heard it before. The mother's message was, the message of Sri Aurobindo is a sunshine radiating over the future. Then, since the beginning of earth history, Sri Aurobindo has always presided over the great earthly transformations under one form or another, one name or another. All through history, Sri Aurobindo played an active part, especially in the most important moments of history. He was there and playing the most important part, but he was not always visible. What Sri Aurobindo represents in the world's history is not a teaching, not even a revelation. It is a decisive action direct from the Supreme. Sri Aurobindo's birth is eternal in the history of the universe in four different ways, on four ascending planes of consciousness. Physically, the consequences of the birth will be of eternal importance in the world. Mentally, it is a birth that will be eternally remembered in the universal history. Psychically, a birth that recurs forever from age to age upon earth. Spiritually, the birth of the eternal upon earth. Sri Aurobindo has come on the earth not to bring a teaching or a creed in competition with the previous creeds or teachings, but to show the way to overpass the past and to open concretely the route towards an imminent and irresistible future. Sri Aurobindo came to tell the world of the beauty of the future that must be realized. He came to give not a hope, but a certitude of the splendor towards which the world moves. The world is not an unfortunate accident. It is a marvel which moves towards its expression. The world needs the certitude of the beauty of the future, and Sri Aurobindo has given that assurance. Sri Aurobindo came to tell us, one need not leave the earth to find the truth. One need not leave the life to find his soul. One need not abandon the world or have only limited beliefs to enter into relation with the Divine. The Divine is everywhere, in everything, and if He is hidden, it is because we do not take the trouble to discover Him. Sri Aurobindo came upon earth to teach this truth to men. He told them that man is only a transitional being living in a mental consciousness, but having the possibility of acquiring a new consciousness, the truth consciousness, and capable of living a life perfectly harmonious, good and beautiful, happy and fully conscious. During the whole of his life on earth, Sri Aurobindo gave all his time to establish in himself this consciousness he called supramental, and to help those gathered around him to realize it. Sri Aurobindo incarnated in a human body the supramental consciousness and has not only revealed to us the nature of the path to follow and the method of following it so as to arrive at the goal, but has also, by his own personal realization, given us the example. He has provided us with the proof that the thing can be done and the time is now to do it. He has come to bid the earth to prepare for its luminous future. Sri Aurobindo's books represent a whole understanding, a whole knowledge, and a whole power, and so each one of his books is at once a symbol and a representation. Each book of Sri Aurobindo contains symbolically, potentially, what is there in him. Sri Aurobindo excludes nothing. He combines all and synthesizes all points of view. Sri Aurobindo is the champion of true freedom, beyond all rules and limits, the total freedom of the perfect union with the Supreme and Eternal Truth. Sri Aurobindo is constantly among us and reveals himself to those who are ready to see and hear him. Sri Aurobindo is always with us, enlightening, guiding, protecting. We must answer to his grace by a perfect faithfulness. Sri Aurobindo does not belong to the past nor to history. Sri Aurobindo is the future advancing towards its realization. He still shows us the way to follow in order to hasten the realization of a glorious future fashioned by the Divine will. To express our gratitude to Sri Aurobindo, we can do nothing better than to be a living demonstration of his teaching. The best homage that we can render to Sri Aurobindo on his centenary is to have a thirst for progress and to open all our being to the divine influence of which he is the messenger upon the earth. Before we aim to be a living demonstration of his teaching, it is right that we have a correct understanding of his teaching. And it is with that end in view that we have been studying one of his major works, The Synthesis of Yoga, for the last few months. We have been, for quite a long time, in the chapter on the essence of sacrifice. We have seen that the life of man whether he is aware of it or not. He is a constant ascent. Ascent from darkness to light, from non-being to being, from ignorance to knowledge. The ascent is also the road of sacrifice. Sacrifice, not in the sense in which it is understood normally, but in the sense of a self-consecration, of a giving up of oneself to the divine in the universe and above the universe. It is in the measure in which we participate in this cosmic sacrifice that is in progress ever since the Creator launched the universe on its career, that our progress, our life is meaningful or not meaningful. Whether we are aware of it or not, whether we will it or not, we are obliged to sail with the movement of sacrifice. A seeker of the divine goes to the root of the question, analyzes the different elements of the sacrifice, finds his way to join the root of the sacrifice, and participates consciously. We have seen how the yoga of knowledge participates in this sacrifice, the sacrifice of knowledge. We have studied the role of love in the sacrifice of life. We have had occasion to discuss the truth that is behind love, or the truth that is love, how love is the kerosene of creation, as a poet put it, how love is the original creative force, an irresistible power, and love it is which has not only issued the universe, but is going to save it. We came at a point where we discussed love in its general dimension. And today's theme is how precisely the yoga of works, the sacrifice of the ascent of sacrifice, treads the path of love. It may or may not be conceivable to the mind how human love, human passion, can be transmuted by the alchemy of grace into a divine, causeless and selfless love. The heart has a certain perception of its possibility. But how precisely is this perception and experience of love to be expressed, to be worked out in the day-to-day program of life, of one's works and duty and service? As of old, all religions have recorded saints, mystics, who have opened to the rule of love in their soul, rejecting the actions of life and closing themselves in the cloister of the soul, adoring the beloved, and perhaps allowing a few of the currents of love to flow into the world. There are those who have demarcated the activities of life as those that can help and promote the movement of love in the heart, and reject all else as irrelevant, if not contrary. There are also those whom we call humanitarians, who bring in an element of ethics and say that even those activities which help the progress of humanity around on the ethical plane, strengthen their sense of morality, give them wider opportunities to live and progress, works of philanthropy, they are germane to the seeker of divine love. Sri Aurobindo points out that all these little distinctions and demarcations mean very little to the seeker of the integral ideal, for his aim is to accept the whole world as it is, inundate the field of life with the waves of love that flow from his heart center, moisten every bit of life's activity with the sap of love. His aim is to turn the whole of his life into an adoration of the divine. Would the divine accept? Does the divine care to accept a consecration, an offering of a commonest act of day-to-day life? Sri Aurobindo cites the famous verse in the Gita wherein the Lord declares that whether you offer a leaf, a flower, a drop of water, anything, any act, if there is the spirit of devotion behind it, I accept. He accepts what man gives. He responds to every approach of man. As he approaches, so he accepts. This being the declaration of the divine, Sri Aurobindo exalts the whole of life, all the activities of life, into means for the adoration of the divine. He makes a distinction between the form of the act and the spirit of the act. He does not agree with those purists who say that the form is inconsequential provided the spirit is right. Sri Aurobindo gives both the form and the indwelling spirit in equal importance. He is one of the few mystics and thinkers who have given full importance to physical form. He records elsewhere also that the outer form is the just configuration of the spirit, of the consciousness that seeks to express itself to it. As the consciousness grows, as the consciousness changes, the subtle eye can perceive changes in the contour of the even the physical form. So the form of the act, the precise manner of doing the act, is as important as the spirit, as the attitude behind it. That is where the truth of physical worship comes in. Intellectuals, monistic spiritualists are inclined to dismiss the mode of worship as belonging to the domain of the ignorant. But there is a profound truth in the mode, in the form of physical worship. Living as we do on the physical plane, a physical figure, a physical form has the imperative advantage of giving a firm establishment to the consciousness that seeks to organize itself on earth. Possibly on these higher planes, on the subtler planes, forms are not important in the sense they are to us here, because there the forms are constantly changing, except on earth, where forms are firm, rigid, with a purpose. Elsewhere, forms change from moment to moment. A perception into this truth most of us have in dreams. We see the same figure changing. A square becomes a circle becomes another triangle, man becomes woman, all these things. The adaptability of form belongs to the subtler planes. On the physical plane, the precise form has a meaning. That is why Mother is so particular about the neatness, about the eye for perfection in the outline of form, whether with children or with adults. She once told me how, when she was in Japan, when she entered some houses, she found something uncouth, something unaesthetic. She would look round and just she would pick up the articles in the drawing room, rearrange them in a minute or two, and it would be a picture of beauty. That shows how much she cares for the expression of beauty, and beauty is the expression of truth on the physical plane. This much by way of a side remark. The act of worship, the mode of worship, the way in which we do an act as neatly as possible, as harmoniously as possible, plus the symbolic aspect of the act, that it represents an effort, it represents a movement within of consecration, of reaching out to the divine. Third is a moment-to-moment exertion of the seeking for the divine, not only there above, but around in the universe. Action flows out. Your action touches 100 people, 100 centers, 100 items. You have to be conscious, grow conscious, that it is the divine in so many units, in so many centers, that receives your offering. Work done in love for the divine, who is seated not only here, but seated in all around, in the meanest worker, in the poor boy around, in the animals, in all creation. The love that throbs to the million-bodied love, the God of love with million souls, that alone has the liberating force that is ascribed to the creative love. If it may be asked, love has such power as ascribed to it by Sri Aurobindo in the Mother, as a creative force, as the mother of the universe, why is it that we do not see love flourishing on earth? Why is it not so dominating even after millions of years of evolution. That is because of the sense of division, separativity in consciousness. Each unit is separate from the rest. However much man is advanced today compared to his ancestors thousands of years ago, it is very rarely that he truly loves others. His sole occupation and preoccupation is to exert for himself, for his interests, to exert for himself in others, as far as the others subserve his interests, whether they are his relations or friends, how they can be utilized to further his interests. His service to them, his interest in them, is commonly activated by self. It is only as man grows beyond the belt of ignorance and selfishness that he begins to awake to the need of exerting himself truly for others. It is a matter of evolution of consciousness, widening the horizons of mind before the true vibrations of love in action can be felt. The aim of this yoga is to discover love at one's source. Love is there at the source of all, but it is most easy and direct to discover it at the source of one's own being, like a spring it oozes out, like a gentle spring it moves. In our purest moments, when we forget ourselves, when the mind is still, love awake. There is no excitement. When love divine comes, moves forward, there is no excitement, no thrill. There is this silent bliss that all is there. The whole universe floats in a sea of love. One doesn't need to exert with the breath goes out, awakening of the love within and its spreading into the corridors of the being. There are obstructions at every step, obstructions posed by the obscurity of the physical body, the impurities of the turbid flow of life, the knots of ego, the crookednesses of the cunning mind, the aridities of the logical mind, all of them combine to break up this movement of love into bits. They either fragment it or twist it, give it a shape that perverts it totally out of character. to prevent this sort of distortion of the divine love that has begun to outflower in you, the only way, Sri Aurobindo points out, is to awaken the psychic being. The psychic being also has the same difficulty. Every ray of its light, every influence is interrupted by so many veils that intervene between the surface being and the psychic at its core. By sheer aspiration, call and evocation, the psychic being must be strengthened by helpful movements in our surface nature, by constant remembrance and dwelling upon its need to come forward. The psychic being has to be drawn out like, as the Rishi says in one of the Upanishads, like the thin fiber out of a blade of grass. The psychic is to be drawn out, strengthened, listened to, obeyed, encouraged, given a shape, given a personality, given scope to develop into a personality. It is only when the psychic being comes forward and sheds its light on the rest of the movements of the being, it is only when the psychic being comes forward and sheds its light on the rest of the movements of the being that the divine love or the purer love from within gets an opportunity to organize itself, to flow out and suffuse the actions of one's day-to-day life, the sacrifice of work with its warmth and purity and creative power. It is again this psychic power which establishes a bridge, as it were, between the individual human nature, such as it is, even when purified, and the power of the truth will, the gnosis above. That too, in its descent to the human plane, is faced with so many obstructions. But if the psychic door is open, if the psychic aspiration or the psychic movement shoots up, the action of the gnosis, the supramental consciousness, gets a scope, a way to reach down to the individual soul. And when the supramental consciousness touches the love as manifest in man, it acquires its true dynamic character, the most important part of which is to perceive the one divine in the many. You begin to love each one in the universe, each form in the universe, with the same intensity, with the same abandon with which you love the one with whom you started your career. Any questions?
Yes. Is there such a thing as psychic tears?
Psychic
tears?
Naturally. Is there such a thing as psychic tears? There are tears and tears. Everyone likes to think that his tears far from the psyche. But truly, there is a distinction between the weeping of the psychic and the tears of the psychic. The psychic weeps when the outer being insists on being stupid without responding to the pressure from within. When it insists in turning its back on the guidance afforded by the psychic. When the soul is ready for the leap, but the outer nature refuses to cooperate, the psychic weeps, the soul weeps. And when that stage arrives, if man does not change, either the soul leaves the body or the major part of it withdraws, leaving only a fragment of it in the body to continue. But the tears are, as far as my experience goes, when you perceive the divine either as beauty or as bliss everywhere, in another individual, without reference to yourself, absolutely without reference, when you are overcome by the marvel of the divine manifestation, the psychic tears of joy, or when you are moved by the suffering of others, when you find the divine purpose suffering due to the crudity and irresponsiveness of the human individual around, the psychic bursts with tears. They are tears of regret. But the psychic tears don't exhaust. One doesn't feel weak after the psychic tears are shed. They have a great purifying change, I won't say effect, but a definite change. Man already registers a step ahead after the psychic tears have been shed. And the movement of catharsis has been gone through.
You refer to soul withdrawing in certain circumstances. The major part of the soul withdraws, but leaves a small portion behind. This is not very clear. If the soul is in the body, either in entirety or not there in entirety.
It is when the soul are undeveloped, it is only a fragment. But as the soul develops a personality, it is not confined to the body. Its center is there. But when it finds the body not responsive to its needs, when it decides that this body is not going to serve me anymore, but the body has some karma to be worked out, to be gone through, a fragment of it is there, but the major part withdraws. That is why you see many who are outstandingly spiritual at some stage in their life, when they begin to deteriorate, their inner being withdraws. But it doesn't force the body to fall down. The embodiment has to work out certain karma. So the only outer cell is left. But the real soul has withdrawn. There have been number of cases in our ashram where the soul that came with the aspiration has been disappointed, left, mostly left and detached, leaving the body and outer self. Just to give an analogy, in dream, in out-of-the-body experiences, when the being goes out, a part of it is still there. The whole of it doesn't go. Normally what happens, the major part stays in the body, a part of it is projected elsewhere. But as one develops the occult technique, the being, central being, may go out for its work, for work for the divine or work for whatever kind. But a part of it continues to animate the body.
If you don't have a link, you will be very involved.
Unless there is a cataclysmic change due to some grace or some providential shock, and the outer nature begins to, and it is reawakened, and begins to respond to the little that is left there, when that happens, the being can come back. Can come back. Yes? Even as early as 2000 years ago, your namesake, in his famous aphorisms on bhakti, he says, the fine result of devotion is love. Devotion is a general movement, self-regarding, praying something for oneself, offering to another. But when this personal element, self element, this drop falls out and devotion turns itself into an absolutely God-regarding movement, forgetting oneself, it becomes an adoration. And this adoration develops into love. Devotion, inner adoration, reaching its climax in love. Love, we can say, is the fine flower of, is the fine fruit of devotion. In the seventh chapter that Sri Aurobindo has written in the synthesis of yoga on the way of life, you will find an exceedingly beautiful description of this graduation of bhakti into love.
The earth, the reinforced psychic being, is the next step in that, the continuation of the human force in an offering to the physical body.
The psychic aid, it helps in making the offering deeper and larger. So a part of working out this self-offering, self-consecration, is the fact at the root of the psyche. It is a simultaneous process. As one develops, the other comes up. As the psyche emerges, the movement of consecration spreads. So both are simultaneous interdependent. They are present not only in the ashram, but even outside.
There are people who are not even his disciples. So then, mother and Sri Aurobindo, this distinction of disciples and non-disciples never arises. Ashram and non-ashram never comes. It is a functional arrangement. She herself said that when the difference of different consciousness takes place,